Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly magazine of the Bay Area performing arts scene. I'm your host, David LaTulip. This afternoon, a return visit from Bill English from the SF Playhouse, who will share his director's viewpoint of Promises, Promises. Conductor Erica Koyovsky talks about the Redwood Symphonies concert this coming Saturday. We'll also hear about upcoming performances of the San Francisco Early Music Society. Plus, critic-at-large Peter Robinson will be by to offer a couple of movie reviews. Stay with us.
I'm all through with promises, promises now. I don't know how I got the nerve to walk out. If I shout, remember, I feel free. Now I can look at myself and be proud. I'm laughing out loud. Oh, promises, promises, this is where those promises, promises. And I won't pretend that what was wrong can be right. Every night I'll sleep now, no more lies. Things that I promised myself fell apart, but I found my heart. Oh, promises, they're kind of promises, take all the joy from life. Promises can just destroy your life. Oh, promises, promises, my kind of promises can lead to joy and hope and love. Yeah.
That's the title track of the original Chuck Baxter before his fantastically later career available to a new generation as Lenny Briscoe in Law and Order in Promises, Promises. Jeffrey Bryan Adams stars in as the Chuck Baxter role in the San Francisco Playhouse of Promises, Promises. Music by the great Burt Bacharach. Hal David did the lyrics on a book by Neil Simon. Directed by Bill English, now through January 10th at SF Playhouse. Nominated for 4 Tony Awards and based on the 1960 Oscar-winning Billy Wilder film, The Apartment, the comedy features a book by Broadway legend Neil Simon, songs by Hal David and Burt Bacharach, as I mentioned, and having the wonderful songs in it, such as that title track, Promises, Promises, and I'll Never Fall in Love Again. Founded by Bill English and Susie DaMilano in 2003, the San Francisco Playhouse was described by the New York Times as a company that stages some of the most consistently high-quality work around and deemed ever-adventurous by the Bay Area News Group. Bill English is coming here to studio today. Bill has directed many of the shows at SF Playhouse. He co-founded the San Francisco Playhouse and in 10 years has overseen its growth from a storefront to a major regional theater company with 6-play main stage series, a 2-play world premiere series, an education program, and a new works program that has commissioned 10 playwrights. Bill is truly a Renaissance man who has won or been nominated for Bay Area Critics Circle Awards in 6 different disciplines: actor, director, set, sound, and lighting designer. He's also a carpenter who has designed and built his own 4-story custom cliff house and 5 theaters in the San Francisco Bay Area. Renaissance man indeed. Welcome back, Bill English.
Good to see you, David.
Boy, what great timing you have to be presenting Promises, Promises right now in the San Francisco Bay Area. First of all, the madman craze that has swept the country thanks to that series. The timing of the show set during the holidays. Burt Bacharach himself coming to be with the San Francisco Symphony in next month on the 10th and 11th. Good work. Good
You'd
timing.
You'd almost think that was deliberate.
Huh? Well, I was going to ask you, how does the planning stages go for presenting a musical like this?
Well, there's so many musicals. There's so many great plays. Promises, Promises has always been one of my favorites. I was listening to that tune, and as a musician, former musician myself, used to play oboe in the orchestra and piano. I was reading that song, a lot of that song is written in 11-4.
It's very bizarre. I was just mentioning to you that I learned the tune recently for a little Broadway review thing. But it falls so naturally. It really does. Once
you don't
learn.
Notice that Bert is playing with all these strange meters. A measure of 5-4, a measure of 3-4, two measures of 7-4, a measure of 4-4, and then a measure of 11-4. So it kind of drives musical directors and singers crazy, but it's just amazing, amazing sound. But I think I'm always looking for a holiday show, which is different, which isn't Christmas Carol or The Nutcracker or something along those lines. And so, when I'm scrolling through the availability of shows, I think a lot of people don't really think of Promises, Promises as a Christmas show, but of course it takes place New Year's Eve. The girl ODs on New Year's Eve, so it's definitely a holiday show and based on The Apartment.
You gave away part of the plot, and if people aren't familiar with the plot of The Apartment, why don't you tell us a brief synopsis of Promises, Promises?
Well, it's the same story as The Apartment, started by Billy Wilder, that starred Jack Lemmon and Shirley MacLaine, and it's a story about an enterprising young junior executive that wants to work his way up the corporate ladder by loaning his apartment out to his bosses to have affairs with their secretaries, thereby gaining favor and moving him up the rung of success.
Having that $86.50 a month apartment on West 67th Street, right?
Right. As he says, it may not be much, but it's mine.
Exactly. Well, you got a great actor playing that, Jeffrey Bryan Ann Adams, who stars as Chuck Baxter. And he is... appeared as the prince in Into the Woods in your production.
That's right. That's when he first came to us, and we noticed immediately that we had a pretty amazing talent on our hands in the smaller role of the prince. And that, you don't really want to do Promises, Promises unless you have somebody that can do Chuck. It's sort of the defining feature. It's like doing Zorba without a Zorba. And so I was not actually willing to commit to the show without sort of making sure that I had somebody who could do it. We actually had Jeffrey and Monique and Corey come in just to sing through and talk through some of the scenes, just to see how it felt before I actually committed to the show.
Mm-hmm. And you're also reuniting some familiar faces that we've seen in other SF Playhouses productions. King Arthur and Guinevere are back together from
That's right.
Camelot.
Mm-hmm.
The King Arthur character of Johnny Moreno, is that right?
Yes.
He's playing J.D. Sheldrake, and Monique Hafen as Fran Kubelik.
That's correct. And they were also Henry Higgins and Liza Doolittle in My Fair Lady. So they've become quite the Lunton Fontan of the San Francisco.
I was going to say, is SF Playhouse becoming more like a repertory theater in terms of some of the same characters coming in and out of different parts?
We've never really set out to be a company in the sense of having a strict group of actors that did all the work. But we definitely have people who are faves and who we work with over and over again. Gabe Marin, Craig Marker, Carl Lumley, Susie Damolano, of course, is Lauren English, Ray Reinhardt is a perennial favorite. So even though we don't have a company, we have a lot of people that we work with consistently.
I think part of that, too, is my own becoming more familiar with the San Francisco theater scene and seeing these faces in different roles. It's really exciting to see the versatility that we have right here in the Bay Area.
Yeah, and then when you work with people over and over again, you develop a shorthand for communications so that they understand you more quickly and you them, and so you can just go farther.
Mm-hmm. I have to also give a shout out to your dance captain, who's also playing one of the major roles. Rudy Guerrero, is it?
Rudy.
Rudy.
Yes.
He was last seen also in...
He was in Camelot.
Right.
He played Sir Dinadan or something like that. And he also played Cousin Julio in The Mother Blipper with the Hat, which was his first appearance with us. And we adore Rudy. Rudy's a very, very passionate, disciplined performer.
and such sharp choreography. He's the dance captain, so I had my eyes riveted on him. He had all the moves down rather well.
He does. That's his first time being a dance captain, and I was not aware that his dance skills were so good. In Camelot, he was more like wielding a scimitar, expertly, of course, but I didn't realize he was such a strong dancer. And Kimberly Richards, of course, is a choreographer, and she's responsible for the choreography. And then Rudy is sort of the leader of the corps.
Right. I was going to ask, as director, are you guiding Kimberly, saying, I really want to see some intricate choreography? There's some really fun choreography once you see the show. It's just really well done.
Absolutely. But Kim and I have worked together for like more than a quarter century. And the great thing about Kim is she's not just a choreographer. She's an actor and a comedian. And her dance experience goes back to aerial work in Las Vegas. So she's a really, really unique and gifted person to have, especially when you're working with choreography that needs to be comic and character-driven. A lot of choreographers do a lot of steps that are, you're going, oh my God, what a good step. But with Kim, you're seeing the story be moved forward by the work. I wanted very much to, especially with the executives, to have them sort of dance like you imagine corporate executives would dance. So we looked at a lot of videos and found some very kind of rigid, almost automated male movement that we were really attracted to. And so she kind of worked with that as the inspiration. We wanted them to try and dance like you would dance if office work were choreographed.
Well, it's almost a touch of How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying.
Oh, for sure. Definitely a business world musical,
Right.
How Now, Dow Jones, which is another forgotten business musical that probably deserves a revival.
I was going to say, might that be on the horizons for SF Playhouse?
I wouldn't rule it out.
You mentioned earlier that you did see a production of Promises, Promises, You Always Wanted to Do It. I'm wondering how much of that early production that you saw influenced what we're seeing on the Playhouse stage versus, say, some of the Mad Men influence.
Well, I actually did never see it. I've listened to the score when I was, a teenager, listening to Burt Bacharach, we're listening to Jerry Orbach and Jill O'Hara sing those amazing songs. I was completely in love with the score by the time I was 12, but I never actually did see it. But I think, Mad Men was an influence for sure. I like at the Playhouse, we do musicals, but we always try to bring a little of our sort of naturalistic, gritty aesthetic to the musicals. And while Promises, Promises is very much a musical, it does deal with a difficult social issue, which is the misogynistic male world, the corporate world of that time, and the subjugation of objectification of women in the workplace, which I think we still are troubled by, and the whole way in which the corporate mentality sort of diminishes our capacity to be truly human. Success at all costs. There's really no morality involved in that. It's just simply what you have to do to win, to get ahead. And that, of course, is where Chuck starts out. He's kind of willing to trade his soul in his apartment for sexual favors to his bosses so he can get advancement. Well, that's a tough little story.
Works for me. No,
yeah.
I'm just
kidding. Yeah. No, that's a tough little story, and the fact that this girl is, having an affair with this married guy who's basically sleeping with all the girls in the company. So it's a difficult social situation and a difficult commentary on our culture that these people, the businessmen and the secretaries and even the executives, are basically not the villains, but they're operating under a false sense of ethics that they've been fed and told and taught since they were little, that this was what success meant and this is what it means to get ahead. And yet they're crippled inside and just dying to make contact, to reach out to other people and have meaningful relationships. But the world the world in which they live doesn't really assist them in that.
Mm-hmm. So you're kind of, it's social commentary to a point, but with a heavy dose of comedy and a real look at that era of America.
Yeah, a heavy dose of satire and a dazzling musical score that is just unbelievably entertaining. It's like you got that driving rhythms of of turkey lurkey time, and a fact can be there are some huge and magnificent production numbers in the show.
I also have to give a shout out to your great use of projection for the way the scenes change, and we're actually moving up and down this skyscraper through the creative use of projected images, and as well as street scenes of New York of the time.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun to take contemporary technology of rear projection video and try to create a lot of Broadway sets, because we really don't have much fly space or wing space, and yet the show calls for about 15 different sets. So rear projection video is a really good way to make that happen.
Right. That's Bill English. He's directing Promises, Promises now through January 10th, 2015. A great show for the holidays. Great show if you're a fan of Mad Men or just want a little slice of that era of Americana. And, of course, the infectious tunes of Bacharach and David. Bill, I wish you a fantastic run and more wonderful success at the really beautiful SF Playhouse. If you haven't been to the SF Playhouse, please do make a journey over there, sfplayhouse.org. Thanks, Bill.
Thanks so much, David.
We're going to go out with one of those other blockbusters from the show. I Say a Little Prayer for You. What do you get when you fall in love?
What do you get when you fall in love? A guy with a pin to burst your bubble. That's what you get for all your trouble. I never fall in love again. Fall in love again. What do you get when you kiss a guy? You get enough germs to catch pneumonia. After you do, he'll never phone ya. I never fall in love again. What it's all about, 'cause I've been there and I'm glad I'm out. Out of those chains that bind you. That is why I'm here to remind you. What do you get when you fall in love? You only get lies and pain and sorrow. So for at least until tomorrow, never fall in love again. I'll never fall in love again.
What do you get when you give your heart? You get it all broken up and battered. That's what you get, a heart that's shattered. I'll never fall in love again. I'll never fall in love again. Don't tell me what it's all about, 'cause I've been there and I'm glad I'm out. Out of those chains that bind you.
That is why I'm here to remind you.
What do you get when you fall in love? You only get lies and pain and sorrow. So for at least until tomorrow,
I'll
never fall in love again. I'll never fall in love again. I'll never fall in love again.
Original cast members Jerry Orbach and Jill O'Hara from Promises, Promises, I'll Never Fall in Love Again. Once again, that terrific show is being performed at the San Francisco Playhouse under the direction of Bill English. For all information, sfplayhouse.org, now through January 10th. Good afternoon. Oh, I should also remind you that in 2 weeks' time, I'll be talking with Burt Bacharach. I interviewed him a couple weeks ago in anticipation of Burt's appearance on the 10th and 11th of December with the San Francisco Symphony. So tune in 2 weeks from today to hear that interview. I'm David Latulippe. That's Open Air, our performing arts magazine here on KALW. Still to come, critic-at-large Peter Robinson will be talking about a couple of films. Dorothy Manley will be here to talk about the San Francisco Early Music Society's new season as well. Redwood Symphony presents its 30th gala season with a concert on November 22nd, Mahler's Ninth Symphony on the program. Led for all those years by Eric Kujawski, who established the Redwood Symphony in 1985 after receiving his doctorate in conducting from Stanford that year. He has performed with the Aspen Music Festival, various Bay Area orchestras and choruses, including Theater Works and Palo Alto. In 1996, he brought the symphony to Davies Symphony Hall with the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus. Celebrating 30 years with the symphony this season, he joins me in studio to talk about their special anniversary season, which opens Saturday, November 2nd, and Mahler's Ninth Symphony. Maestro, welcome to KALW. Welcome back to KALW.
It's a pleasure to be here, David. Thanks for having me.
For those that aren't familiar with this, yet another Bay Area symphonic treasure, why don't you tell us a little bit about the history of the Redwood Symphony?
Well, when I finished the Stanford program, there were no jobs for me on the horizon. And I was facing a terrifying prospect of maybe going years before I would be in front of an orchestra again after the Stanford Symphony. So I decided really to start my own orchestra. But if I was going to do it, I decided it should be on my terms, and it would be the sort of ideal community orchestra structured from the ground up in a new way. So one thing that I made very clear at the beginning was no matter how desperate we were, we would never pay ringers, you know, professionals to come in. So it had to be really volunteer. And in order to create more of a team spirit, I have always rotated the string players so that there's no hierarchy, and all the winds, brass, percussion are co-principals. So there's never this sense that why am I in the second chair when so-and-so is not as good as me and that sort of thing. We also have experimented with the concert format. We were the first local group to use super titles for all vocal works and programmatic works to show the audience where they are in the piece. We don't wear suits and ties. We're much more casual in our dress. And the main thing, though, is that we attract some of the best community amateur players by doing repertoire that is normally considered too difficult for a community orchestra to do.
Well, so, Mahler 9 is not exactly a walk in the woods.
Yeah, and Mahler 9 actually is the beginning of our third time through the Mahler symphonies. So we've done two complete cycles, almost two complete cycles.
Wow.
We haven't done the eighth twice yet.
Uh-huh.
So that, because that takes a lot of doing to just get all the forces together.
They don't call it a symphony of a thousand for nothing.
That's right. That's right. But so we've done the Mahler symphonies. We've done quite a bit of Stravinsky and Bartok, Sibelius, John Adams, John Carigliano, you know, a lot of the modern composers. And that's really where our specialty is. But we also do the traditional repertoire as well. And I do try to do a mix on a season that equally covers the 20th, 19th centuries, and even a little of the 18th century.
And what's your home concert venue?
We're at Kenyatta College. That's spelled like Canada, of course, for those listeners who haven't heard of it before. It's 280 I-280 in Redwood City. It's a very nice hall, air-conditioned, about 500 seats, and we've been selling it out recently, which is great.
So tell us a little bit more about what's happening for this 30th anniversary season.
Well, after the Mahler 9th, we go to February. Besides the Berlioz Symphonie Fantastique, we are doing the West Coast premiere of a new Michael Dougherty concerto called G's Bend, and it's a concerto for electric guitar, which I'm really looking forward to. It's a wonderful piece that uses a wide variety of American popular styles, and it's based on the G's Bend is a town in, I believe, Alabama that is known for its quilting. And so each movement has to do with a quilt that has been produced by that town. So that's a wonderful piece. Later on in the season, we're doing Sibelius's Seventh Symphony. It's not done that often, but it's an incredible piece. Bartok's Second Violin Concerto with Miranda Liu. The Ravel opera, L'Enfant et les Sortilèges, which means The Child and the Spells. It's probably Ravel's greatest work and hardly ever done.
That's in collaboration with the Bayshore Lyric Opera Company.
That's right.
Have you worked with them before?
Yes. We did. I've worked with them before. Last year, we did. What did we do? It was Carmen. I did Carmen last year with them. So now they're performing with my orchestra, and that'll be fun. And the climax of our season, which will coincide with our 30th anniversary, we're doing a concert called Rites, Stravinsky and Orff. As you would expect, it's the Rite of Spring, and with it, Carmina Burana, which is perhaps more music than anyone has a right to do on one program. But we'll try it.
Very nice. So tell me, you've gone through the Mahler cycle three times already or so. What are you rediscovering every time you come through the Mahler 9?
Well, you know, the Mahler 9th of all those symphonies is the most personal piece of his. It's perhaps the greatest work that sets as its goal to depict what it's like to grapple with death and departure and leave taking, and it's a very powerful work, very cathartic, and to perform it, I think it just requires more than for most pieces. For any Mahler symphony, I have to keep the overall architecture of the piece in mind. A conductor, of course, has to be in the moment, correcting things as they happen. But at the same time, I have to be thinking a little bit ahead of what's about to happen, and then the overall architecture of each movement. And, you know, each Mahler movement is over 15 minutes long. So keeping everything in place in my mind, all the climaxes and making sure that they are the right strength leading up to the big climax, these sort of things, it takes a lot of study and just interiorizing the piece to the point where I don't even have to think about it anymore.
How did you first come to Mahler?
Well, that's a funny story. When I was at UCLA as an undergraduate, I had heard about Mahler and I thought I'd check him out. And so I would take scores at the music library and sit down for a couple hours and listen to the symphonies. But I think I picked the wrong ones. They didn't appeal to me. I started with number 7. Which is a strange work and one of my favorite pieces now, but I didn't get it. And I didn't get Symphony number 5 either. And so I was not really listening to Mahler, and I had a class with the LA Times music critic Martin Bernheimer on music criticism. This was after Zubin Mehta had left, and they were looking for a new music director. And so Mr. Bernheimer said in class, everyone should go to see the LA Phil do Mahler's 9th with Carlo Maria Giulini. And I said, well, you know, I'm not really into Mahler that much. And Martin said, well, if you don't like Mahler's 9th under Carlo Maria Giulini, you will never like Mahler. I thought, well, I'll give it one more try. And I went, and I have to say it was one of the experiences of my life to hear that particular symphony with that great conductor. It was just a mind-numbing experience, and so after that I devoured all the symphonies, and he's one of my favorite composers now.
Great. It's Mahler's 9th symphony being performed Saturday, November 22nd. It's the Redwood Symphony's Gala 30th anniversary season. Information about all things at Redwood Symphony at their website, redwoodsymphony.org. Dr. Eric Kujawski. I wish you a wonderful concert and a fantastic season. Congratulations on number 30.
Thank you again, David.
An excerpt of the third movement of the Ninth Symphony of Gustav Mahler to be performed by the Redwood Symphony this Saturday. Information at redwoodsymphony.org. Speaking of symphonies, if you'd rather not travel down the peninsula, here in town on Saturday, the Bay Area Rainbow Symphony will be presenting their concert under the direction of guest conductor Michael Morgan. Music of Conrad Susa, some Mahler as well, Kinder Totenlieder on the program, as well as Tchaikovsky's Second Symphony. Stay with us at the end of the hour. I'll have a ticket giveaway for this Saturday's Bay Area Rainbow Symphony concert. Good afternoon. David Latulipe with you once again. Before the hour's up, we'll also have a visit from Peter Robinson, critic at large, who will review a couple of movies for us, Rosewater, a John Stewart-directed film, and Mr. Turner, which is directed by Mike Lee. Speaking of Mike Lee, or Mike Nichols passed away, we just learned. We'll have a remembrance of him before the hour is out as well. We back up in time just a bit to the San Francisco Early Music Society, which was founded in 1975. It's the only early music community-based service and membership organization in the United States. Under the direction of Harvey Malloy, it is the focal institution in Northern California for the advancement of historically informed performance of early music. Through its concert series, publications, outreach activities, as well as affiliate support and educational programs, SFEMS encourages the development of amateurs and supports professionals, plus increases public involvement and participation in the development of early music. San Francisco Early Music Society is the lead presenter of the Berkeley Festival and Exhibition of Early Music. And joining me to take a moment to talk about their new season is Dorothy Manley, who has been a guest of mine before on Open Air. Dorothy is the operations manager for SFEMS. Welcome back, Dorothy.
Thank you so much, David. Good to be here.
Thank you for coming. Boy, quite a season ahead.
Yes, this is one of the most exciting seasons in a long time. And we are having a number of debut performances for the Bay Area. And it's very exciting to have so many groups coming in, bringing fresh things to our wonderfully rich early music community out here already.
Well, things are starting off with a program called East of the River. Let's start there.
Yes, East of the River will be arriving this afternoon. They're starting to come in.
Slow boat up the river. Okay.
Yes, East of the River. Anyway, they will be presenting a very exciting performance based on their most recent CD called Leventerra, which was produced in the spring of 2013. And this explores the repertoire of the spice trades, which is a very interesting concept. And interestingly enough, it's called Leventera, meaning an east wind, a wind blowing from the east. So the concerts, rather than starting in the West, as we usually think of the spice trade, starting in China and moving across the Middle East into the Balkans, north and south of the Mediterranean, up through Spain and France, and actually into England, we're starting in England this time. So the first piece on the show will be one from the Robert's Bridge Codex, a 14th century English manuscript that has one of the earliest examples of written counterpoint. And this is performed on instruments from the Middle East and the Balkans, which traveled with the spice trade across that part of the world and into both extremes, so fetched up in England. That's going to be one of the signature pieces on the on this concert, which will be this weekend, produced three times, one in Palo Alto and one in Berkeley, one in San Francisco. Additional early pieces will be estampes, which are a particular kind of monodic virtuoso solo dance music from the late 14th century. And early music group east of the river will, instead of doing the monodic one line, they will do a version created by them, that group, for two recorders, canoon, and percussion. And I should perhaps say a little bit about the instruments that they're using in this performance. There will be two recorders, which are probably familiar to most listeners to early music. They are wooden instruments, mouth blown straight down from the mouth with holes for the fingers to make tuning. The ney is another version of that. It is a reed instrument, also mouth blown, and the chalumeau is another instrument curved with cut finger holes, also made of a reed. And with reed, the canoon is basically a zither that is played on the lap and has lots of sound potential from plucking and stringing. And also,
let's back up to the wind instruments for a moment.
Yeah,
that's,
sure.
As a flute player, that's what fascinates me the most.
Yes.
Is to see some of these early instruments and the wonderful different sounds that we're so used to Western styled instruments of having there's the clarinet, there's the oboe, there's
exactly.
The flute. But to hear these early instruments really is very inspiring.
It is a very interesting sound. It puts you sort of in another place. Let's listen to a little clip from the first piece, Patrona, which will feature all these instruments.
And then more with Dorothy Manley and the San Francisco Early Music Society.
Thank you.
a little touch of Petrona, performed by Nina Stern and Daphna Moore from their CD called Lavantera. It's music that you can hear as part of the East of the River performance of the San Francisco Early Music Society this Friday in Palo Alto, Saturday in Berkeley, and then Sunday as a matinee at 4 o'clock at St. Mark's Lutheran Church here in San Francisco. Information at sfems.org. But wait, there's more as the season progresses. Dorothy Manley here to talk to me about what else is happening with
early music. Well, I would
like
to put in a little bit more about these performers on the East of the River concerts. They are all extraordinary performers, and I think they bring so much. You mentioned Daphna Moore and Nina Stern, who play the wind instruments. Tamara Pinarbasi plays canoon, I was saying. Jesse Katansky plays Balkan violin, and he is well known to the local Balkan dance community. So I think his playing will be of interest. And then John Hadfield, you heard a lot of in percussion. And interestingly, he was Yo-Yo Ma's percussionist on his Silk Road project. So we've got some real experts in this production. We have a fantastic performance coming in January, which will be Palada Musica. This group is brand new to the Bay Area. They are from Montreal. They were the invited semifinalists in the Van Wassenaer competition in Utrecht in September, and they have just completed a performance in Montreal of Telemann's Paris Quartets. And they will be on our series doing a performance of they were also the Early Music America Grand Prize winner in 2012. And they will be doing a wonderful performance of music from the Baroque in moving from the so-called stile moderno, which was from the early part of the 17th century, late 16th century, moving into the stilus fantasticus, which has a lot more exciting, unexpected musical motifs going on. In February, we have a Bay Area debut from the Dark Horse Consort, a four-year-old ensemble of sackbut players, many of whom we will hear in December, and cornetto players, also many of whom will be appearing in December, and a keyboard, along with two guest vocalists, sopranos Jelly Greenleaf and Molly Quinn, in this Bay Area debut of music of the triad of Schütz, Schein, and Scheidt, as well as composers that they influenced, including Verdonk and Rosenmüller.
That was my favorite period of studying music history as a music student, to talk about Schütz, Schein, and Scheidt.
Exactly, exactly. And they even have good music, too.
that helped.
Yes. And if you can say it, then you can move on to the next level. And then in March, we will have Artifice, which will be a debut performance for the group, composed of Bay Area favorites Cynthia Freivogel, Tecla Cunningham, Catherine Heater, Daniel Zulaga, and Elizabeth Reed. And they will be presenting music of Salzburg in the generations that preceded Mozart. Some of these names may or may not be familiar, but Heinrich Bieber was quite a violinist. Wils Meyer, Georg Muffat, all created wonderfully exciting and elegant sonatas and concerti for the late 17th century and early 18th century. And then as we move later into the season, in April, we come to the Ensemble Mirable with the inestimable Marion Verbruggen, a stellar recorder player, internationally known. She has been called a miracle of poetry and precision by the New York Times. She has also been a favorite performer in the Bay Area for many years. She has also helped as a workshop instructor at our SVEMS summer workshop, recorder workshops. So we'll be happy to have her back, along with the Ensemble Mirable, which has performed here and includes lots of wonderful Bay Area performers, Junghae Kim, Elizabeth Blumenstock, Katie Keim, Joanna Blundoff, and Kevin Cooper. So we're going to have
ahead. My goodness.
This spectacular year.
All that information is at your website, sfems.org. I'd like you to back up for just a moment to the Magnificat performance that's happening in December, and we'll share some music of that.
Yes, that will be a really, really exciting performance. It's always wonderful to have Magnificat on our concerts. And this December, Warren Stewart will be bringing us the brilliant polychoral music of Francesco Cavalli, and in particular his Missa Concertata, which is one of his most elaborate and celebratory pieces. And I should say that Cavalli was primarily known perhaps as a composer for opera in the 17th century, and performed about 36 works for the stage. So he brings that aesthetic to this extravagant Magnificat, which we believe was in celebration for a victory, a Venetian victory. And this presents older style music from the Palestrina counterpoint, Gabrielli's famous Venetian polychoral techniques, as well as newer recitative and continuo madrigals that were quite popular in the time. And it specializes, this mass features theatrical styles from the opera itself. So that creates these soloistic, elaborate solo motets that are such a feature of opera being transferred into the religious sphere, which was groundbreaking in its day.
Well, let's look forward to that concert as well. More information about that at sfems.org. Dorothy, thanks so much for sharing your comprehensive knowledge of this music. I'd just love to pick your brain about some of these instruments sometime as
that
well.
That would be really fun.
Here's music of Agnus Dei, which will be part of that December 19th to 24th, 21st concert of the San Francisco Early Music Society. Thanks for coming in, Dorothy.
You're welcome.
Large Peter Robinson joins me now for a couple of movie reviews, one of which uses the Leonard Cohen music we're hearing in the background, the John Stewart directed Rosewater. Hi, Peter.
Hi, David. Good to be here. And I'm just thinking about this Leonard Cohen piece of music because it really kept the Iranian-Canadian journalist Mazyar Bahari alive when he was in a prison cell in Tehran. Now, the title, Rosewater, may sound strange for a movie which is about a journalist who was sent in 2009 to cover the Iranian presidential elections, a disputed election. But in fact, he'd only just started filming and there were famous street protests. And the next thing I know, and we know, is that he was arrested and imprisoned. In fact, he was in prison for 118 days. He was under suspicion of spying for the West and using the Newsweek magazine, where he was a reporter, as his cover. And, of course, during his imprisonment, he's beaten, he's questioned, he's tortured, he's put in solitary confinement. And the torturer every day sprays himself with perfume. In fact, he sprays himself with rose water, which is the reason the movie carries this title. Now, I should say a couple of words about Jon Stewart. We know him from the Comedy Central show as the host. This is his first time both as a director and writer. He based his story on the original memoir, Then They Came For Me, written in 2011 by Bahari. And really, Jon Stewart does a wonderful, wonderful piece of storytelling, because in many ways this is a black comedy. It is no joke for a journalist with proper press credentials to be held and tortured, and at the same time there was a kind of irony that Bahari is sufficiently smart that he gets into the head of his torturer, and so in many ways he anticipates when he's going to be beaten. He comes up with creative fantasies that he shares, and as the film reveals, and it's no spoiler, eventually after 118 days he is released. So this is a remarkable bit of, I call it a kind of bio-documentary, but with actors. And the cast is truly international. The Mexican actor Bernal plays Bahari. The torturer is played by a Dane, Badini. And I think it adds to the universal message that although it's set in Tehran based on a real story, there are today many journalists who are being held simply for covering events. And I go back to the old days when I had a National Union of Journalists press card. I was in the Middle East. And in those days, in the 70s, at somehow or other, the press card had some meaning that you were a journalist. Today, in an age of blogging, we've seen that discrimination break up. So I highly recommend a wonderful piece of storytelling. The movie is Rosewater. It's directed by Jon Stewart. And it is the, I believe, true story and faithful rendition of what happened to Mazyar Benhari, an Iranian-Canadian journalist who was held while covering the elections in Tehran in 2009.
Currently playing at the AMC Metreon 16 here in San Francisco.
And by way of contrast, we have got another biopic, and it's a very unusual one. It is based this time on the life of the famous Victorian artist William Turner. And for anyone growing up in England, if you went to the Victorian Albert Museum or any of the major museums, the Tate, at some point you would have been exposed to a Turner painting. The story picks up his life in his later days, roughly from 1828 onwards. It's directed by Mike Lee. It's simply called Mr. Turner. And Timothy Spall does a masterful job creating this highly eccentric artist. Now, just as a side, a few things about Turner's painting, because I think it helps in understanding the film, is that he was the bridge between what I call the early 19th century to what would eventually become Impressionism. So for him, colour is all important. And not only is colour all important, but the sensation of how colour affects both the artist and the canvas. And in one highly dramatic scene, which is based on a real-life incident, he had himself tied to the mast of an old sailing ship as it went through what looks very much like a hurricane. So he has the sea salt in his face, the wind splashing, the waves covering, everything happening, and then he slams it down immediately afterwards on canvas. It's a very, very dramatic piece of artwork. And I think where Mike Lee's direction is good is that he can move from real moving pictures to these famous seascapes, and you get that great in-depth sense of colour that really gave Turner his reputation. Now, the other thing about Turner, I mentioned he was eccentric, very difficult to live with. He has a famous growl when things are going well and when things are going badly. In fact, it's one of those movies where grrr is almost as important as any other word in the dialogue. And speaking of the dialogue, it stays true to Dickensian English. And I think one of the things you take from Dickensian English, people speak more slowly. You can catch what they're saying. There don't seem to be as many ums and ahs. And this quaintness, I think, adds to the richness and certainly to the spirit of time and the spirit of place. Some of the minor characters are truly interesting, particularly the young John Ruskin. Some people have argued that he's presented as a mummy's boy, a little too much to say for himself, and that what Mike Leigh was doing was attacking critics at large. Be that as it may, what I feel is this is a very intense bio-documentary. It's a wonderful insight to anybody interested in art history. If you understand or have any feelings about Victorian history, this takes you right into that spot. And as the main character, Timothy Spall, is extremely believable. This is Turner in the flesh, and I think he brings those masterful brush strokes which we see on his canvas to life in this very lusty, physical, spit-and-spunk portrait of J.M.W. Turner.
Couple of great picks, Peter, and with rain in the forecast, a great time to catch a couple of movies.
That's right. It's coming to the fall, the evenings are getting longer, and that's the time to either curl up with a good book or go to the pictures, as we used to say.
Thanks, Peter. Until next time.
Well, I did mention a ticket giveaway at the beginning of the hour. If you would like to call us here at the studio, 415-841-4134. We have five pairs, or individual seats if you prefer, to the Bay Area Rainbow Symphonies concert this Saturday at Calvary Presbyterian Church on Fillmore Street. Michael Morgan is our guest conductor. We'll hear works by Conrad Sousa, The Blue Hour. Conrad, only recently deceased, was on the faculty of the San Francisco Conservatory of Music. Mahler's Kinder Totenlieder with Zachary Gordon, wonderful baritone singer, as well as Tchaikovsky's Symphony No. 2, The Little Russian. How appropriate, The Little Russian named after Ukraine. Maybe a little politics involved in tonight's concert by the, I'd say, 50 to 60% gay and lesbian San Francisco Bay Area Rainbow Symphony, performing this Russian composer. 415-841-4134. Is the number to call for complimentary tickets to this Saturday's 8 p.m. performance at the Calvary Presbyterian Church, 841-4134. A little bit of music of Arvo Pärt to go out with this edition of Open Air. It was music that I actually chose for Mike Nichols' HBO production of Wit, which starred Emma Thompson back in 2000. I had the good fortune to work with Mike Nichols as his music advisor for that film. He passed away just yesterday at the age of 83. Also, closer to home, a very sincere wishes of condolences to Adele Barnett, wife of Tom Barnett, a wonderful violinist, humanitarian, realtor, bon vivant, a dear friend, leaving us much too soon at the age of 65. Tom, we will miss you dearly. I'm David Latulippe. You've been listening to Open Air. My thanks to Neil Swinkles for herding cats, as it were, and producing and providing segments for Open Air. A reminder that you can catch our shows archived at our website, kalw.org. If you've got a show segment idea, you can send an email to me directly, david@kalw.org. Next week, we're off. We're going to have some music from the a presentation from the Third Coast Radio Festival. You'll hear some great stories from noon to 2 on Thanksgiving Day here on KLW. And I'll be back with you the week after, featuring an interview with Bert Bacharach. Hope you can join me then. News from the BBC is next here on KLW San Francisco.